for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The latest winners in the Race to the Top Education Reform Program were announced late last month. Race to the Top is one of the key components of President Obama's blueprint for overhauling the nation's public schools. Such federal incentives are credited with enticing a number of states to make serious efforts to tackle problems with their school systems. Joining me in the studio to evaluate education reform, Cynthia Brown of the Center for American Progress and Allison Klein of Education Week. We are expecting Frederick Hess of the American Enterprise Institute to join us. But first, joining us from his office here in Washington, D.C., Arnie Duncan. He's U.S. Secretary of Education. And throughout the hour, we'll take your calls. Join us on 800-433-8850. Good morning to you, sir. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Diane. Thanks for having me back on the show. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you. There has been a fair amount of controversy about the Race to the Top winners. How were they chosen? How do you plan to change the process?
Well, we had a great peer review process, and we actually don't, you know, pick them here. We have outside experts who are impartial, and I think overall they did an extraordinary job. And what we saw, as you know, around the country, Diane, is we've seen about 36 states raise standards. You see 44 states working together to come up with much better assessments for students. And this is not just about states that won. This is the entire country moving. This is a national movement. And I give so much credit to governors and state school chief officers and local educators for driving the kind of fundamental and dramatic change that our country needs. And what I think Race to the Top did is it really unleashed this huge amount of creativity and innovation.
And
folks know we need to get better. They know we need to educate our way to a better economy. And the leadership shown at the local level has been simply remarkable.
Tell me how these grant winners in these 11 states and the District of Columbia are going to be held accountable.
So we're going to work with each state and come up with a plan of what their benchmarks are going to be each year. And as long as they're hitting benchmarks, we'll continue to fund them. And if somehow they go off track or veer off course, we'll stop funding them. So we'll hold them accountable on a quarterly basis. And we absolutely expect them to do fantastic work. But if somehow someone slips or falters, we're more than prepared to stop funding. And we had many, many states we would have loved to have funded. We simply ran out of money. There was just tremendous courage showed. And there are lots of folks who would like to come back and fund in a few future Race to the Top initiative.
And you've had many unions and educators raising concerns about linking teacher performance with student outcomes. How are you going to deal with that?
Well, there's actually been real leadership there in Delaware, which is one of the first two states to win along with Tennessee. The head of the state's teacher union, Diane Donahue, has just shown tremendous courage. She was part of the interview team and was absolutely 100% behind the effort. And we've seen great leadership at the local level. You've seen Randy Weingarten, who I think is showing great courage as the leader of the AFT, who has said that as a part of teacher evaluation, student achievement has to be part of that. That just makes common sense. And so I think, Diane, you're seeing the conversation change. You're seeing folks, do some things differently, and we're all going to work together, and we're going to make sure we do the right thing by children. I've said from day one that when we evaluate teachers, we have to look at multiple measures. You should never, ever base a teacher's evaluation or pay or anything else upon one test, one day, once a year. That makes no sense at all. but as a series of multiple measures. Should student achievement be part of how a teacher is evaluated? Absolutely. And what we all have to work together on, Diane, is teacher evaluation is largely broken in this country. Great teachers don't get recognized and rewarded. Teachers who need additional help and support don't get that. And those teachers at the bottom where it's simply not working and they need to, you know, find something else to do, that doesn't happen either. So if it's not working for the best, if it's not working for those in the middle, if it's not working at the bottom, if it's not working for any of the adults, I promise you it's not working for children either.
Okay.
And so as a country, we have to work together to and fix this, and we absolutely want to help see that happen.
Now, you've got midterm elections coming up. You've got several governors where leadership could change in those states. What happens if governors newly elected decide not to comply for those 11 states? Would you then take the money back?
We would have that possibility. But what you saw in many states, I'll give you one example, in Tennessee, which is brilliant. So what Governor Bredesen did, who is he's term limited out, he's done, he got every single potential gubernatorial candidate, Republican and Democrat, to sign up for the plan. And so this isn't about just one person's leadership. This is about an entire state saying that this is our blueprint for reform. This is the direction we want to go. All of us are working together. All of us are moving outside our comfort zones. And this is not about one person. So we'll watch that closely. But we've seen real, you know, forethought and thoughtfulness across the country. But what I thought, you know, Governor Bredesen did was brilliant. So anyone who might be the next governor of Tennessee, all of them are absolutely committed to this plan, and this work will continue to move forward.
All right. You've got right here in the District of Columbia, Mary Fenty, who is several points behind in the prognosis for the upcoming election. And you've got Ms. Ree, who says she will not stay on in D.C., if Mayor Fenty loses. Now, how much of your education reform and race to the top depends on whether Michelle Ree stays in place?
Well, this is about an entire district. Again, it's not about one person. I think there's been real progress here in D.C., frankly, pretty remarkable progress in a short amount of time. This is a district, as you know, Diana, that's been basically broken for far too long. It was a largely dysfunctional district. We've seen remarkable progress in recent years with Mayor Fenty's leadership and with Michelle Ree as the superintendent. And whatever happens politically, obviously you and I don't control that, but the children of D.C. deserve dramatically better than what they've had for a long time. Things are going in the right direction, and that progress desperately needs to continue.
My concern would be that you might have a slide backwards.
Well, that would be my, you know, we can't afford that. And again, the district's come a long way, but there is a long, long way to go. And we absolutely need to see the momentum continue to move forward. There's been, you know, remarkable progress in a short amount of time, and we need to continue to accelerate the rate of change. We can't go backwards. There are far too many children today who live in the district who are receiving a poor education, a woefully inadequate education, and that is just simply unacceptable.
Now, Morton Kondracki in Roll Call has written, "The danger lies in the possibility that Congress will delay action on education reform legislation and that a left-right coalition of reactionaries will consolidate next year to upend the dramatic progress now underway." What do you think?
I'm actually very optimistic, and sure, you need to be aware of concerns, but there's been this amazing quiet revolution around the country. No one is defending a status quo in which we've dropped from first to 12th in college graduates. No one's defending a status quo with a dropout rate from high school of about 25%, and in many of our African-American Latino communities, that dropout rate is closer to 40 and 50%. We know as a country we have to get dramatically better. We've worked very closely closely in a bipartisan way, Republicans and Democrats, House and Senate. Education has to continue to be the one issue that everyone throws politics and ideology to the side, and we simply do the right thing for children. So we want to reauthorize ESEA. We think we can fix so much of what was broken in No Child Left Behind, and we move to reauthorize. We want to work with everybody to do the right thing for children, to do the right thing for education in this country. Nothing is more important.
Do you think the Elementary and Secondary Education Act will be authorized?
I would love to see it happen this year. It may not obviously run out of time, so I'd love to see it happen early in the new year. So this is coming in real time as we speak, and we've been having great conversations with House and Senate leadership, Republicans and Democrats, bipartisan, bicameral, and we think No Child Left Behind was far too punitive. It was very prescriptive. It led to a dumbing down of standards, and it led to a narrowing of the curriculum, and we have to fix all of that. We have to reward excellence. We have to focus much more on growth and gain. We have to provide much more flexibility at the local level, get the federal government off people's back, and leave it up to great local educators to figure out how best to help children learn. We have to have a well-rounded curriculum. And states now are raising standards. As we speak, 35 states, Diane, have adopted college and career-ready standards. They've said together, we're going to stop lying to children. We're going to stop lying to families. We're going to make sure every single child who graduates is truly college and career-ready. That is a fundamental breakthrough, and I'm so proud of that courage and leadership.
And what happens if Tea Party candidates get enough control in the House and Senate and call for the abolition of the Department of Education? Are you there, Mr. Secretary? I'm afraid we've lost him on that last question, and we'll take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk with our other guests. I'm very sorry about that, and I do apologize. And we're back. Unfortunately, we lost Arnie Duncan, the Secretary of Education. Our phone dropped out, or his phone dropped out, not sure which. Here in the studio is Cindy Brown. She's Vice President for Education Policy at the Center for American Progress, Frederick Rick Hess. He's resident scholar and director of education policy studies at the American Enterprise Institute. He's the author of the forthcoming book, The Same Thing Over and Over, and Allison Klein. She's staff writer for Education Week. And we are going to open the phone shortly and take your calls, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can join us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Cindy Brown, you heard what the Secretary had to say as far as concern about making sure that schools that have gotten this extra money are evaluated, that they are doing what they have promised to do. What about accountability?
Well, I think the Race to the Top program has put in place accountability we rarely see in federal grants in education. As the Secretary said, they're going to work with the states to set performance benchmarks so that and then evaluate quarterly whether the states are meeting them. If they're not meeting them, they'll hold back the money till they meet their benchmarks or stop funding them altogether. I think that is accountability. We see that very rarely in federal grants to school districts and
Rick
states.
Rick Hess, how do you see it?
I think if the Secretary follows through on what he said, it would be an intriguing and unprecedented development. We've never seen anything like that. Six of the 12 governors in the states that won Race to the Top money will be changing over come January. 10 of the 12, including the mayor in D.C., may be changing over. Many of the new executives will not be interested necessarily in following through on the programs of their predecessors.
Are you suggesting they turn down money?
Oh, no. I think they'll happily take the money, but they will also very happily not follow through on what they promised to do.
Well, but it sounds as though the Secretary was saying that money would then come back to the federal government if those states do not agree to carry on.
He absolutely has said that. We also, of course, heard similar declarations by Bush's secretaries of education in the last administration, and we saw little or no follow-through on those pledges.
So you're saying you don't believe the Secretary has the authority to pull that money back?
I think he has the authority. I'm very interested to see whether he will choose to do so.
And Allison Klein, what's your reaction?
Frankly, I would be surprised if the Secretary did end up pulling money from Race to the Top winners. It's certainly something that I'll be watching for. We'll just see how this program is implemented. It's certainly an unprecedented federal program.
You're saying that even if states which have won the Race to the Top and have received the money, if their governors change and don't like the program, you're saying they'll take the money, but they won't comply?
I would be surprised if they didn't comply with at least part of what they've promised to do. I think it would be a last resort, frankly, for the department to pull money from a state. My guess is that Secretary Duncan would work with leaders in the state. Certainly there wouldn't have been a turnover in everybody. There may be union leaders, there may be district leaders who really buy into the plan who would still be in place. And I think that the Secretary would try to work with those folks to put pressure on whoever's in the governor's mansion and whoever's in state legislatures to make sure that they follow through on those promises. It's certainly the implementation story is the story with Race to the Top right now. We'll have to see what the states who got this money, what they end up doing with it, whether they follow through on these bold plans they've put forward.
How do they have to comply? Cindy Brown.
Well, these applications were several hundred pages long with great detail and with with points awarded for various subparts in quite a bit of detail. I'm not nearly as pessimistic as my two colleagues here. I believe the department will be strong in taking action if the plans aren't lived up to. Already, this administration, Arne Duncan, and his decision making about who should be awarded grants bucked a lot of politics that would have been favorable to President Obama's party if certain awards had been made. So I'm much more optimistic that he will take strong action. He's been taking strong action.
One of the keys seems to be the question of holding teachers accountable for test scores of their students. How do we do that?
Well, the only way it can be done is if you link teachers with their students, the students they teach. It's a data linkage issue. We have to remember we've made huge progress in the last 10 years. Before the No Child Left Behind Act was passed, there was only one state that reported data on students disaggregated by race, income, and special needs and English language learning. Now every state does. The only way you can do that is if you have grade-by-grade testing so that you can look at the difference in scores from one grade to another, and you can look at the effect that a teacher had on a student's learning. Even if a student comes in behind, we expect a teacher to have success in moving that student forward, even if they're so far behind they don't quite reach grade level. We can show the difference that a teacher makes if we compare one year's test to another. And all of us who are, or most of us who are employed in the for-profit or nonprofit world, are evaluated on the outcomes we achieve. And it just seems only sensible that teachers who are paid every day to work with students be measured to some extent, taking into account extenuating circumstances, but look at the success they've had with their students.
Rick Hess, what about these measurements?
I think absolutely Cindy's right that the secretary and the president deserve real credit for moving as aggressively as they have to put teacher quality on the agenda. They've done this more forcefully than the last administration ever did. That said, I wrote a year ago, and when the Race to the Top was first unveiled in a piece called Failing to Learn Bush's Lessons, that the president and the secretary were at danger of doing to value added and merit pay what the Bush administration did to accountability, and that this was not meant as a compliment. That the problem is these value added mechanisms require a great deal of finesse. The estimates that you get on how effective teachers are really quite unstable until you get to large numbers of students. That the assessments on which they're based are still relatively primitive. I think it's essential and vital that we move forward in the way Cindy suggested on value added, but I do think it is being oversold and overbilled at this moment.
You're going to have to explain to me what you mean by value added.
Sure. Value added is real simple. The way No Child Left Behind calculated school performance, say, was whether your students made it over a testing bar a given year. Value added says the way we should judge schools or teachers is how much progress students make in reading or math in the course of a year.
And what's the difference between that and what the Secretary of Education is calling for now?
No. I'm suggesting that that is what he's calling for, but that in the way that we use value added, we don't judge doctors, for instance, by looking at birth weight at their hospital the year before for 15 or 18 kids and looking at it the succeeding year. What we try to do is recognize that we have to use these kinds of measurement tools in smart and thoughtful ways. And the danger is in too many states right now, most notably last year in Florida's Senate Bill 6, in a recent LA Times expose that ran last month, we are not using value-added measures in smart or thoughtful ways that are aware of their limits. We're getting, once again, the cart ahead of the horse.
Cindy Brown, do you agree with that?
I agree that the measures are less than perfect. The good news is that we're constantly, experts are working on improving them. The problem is it's better than nothing. We've been paying teachers strictly on the basis of their years of service and their graduate school credentials, whether they were strong or weak teachers. And teachers who are not effective do damage to children. Are the measures imperfect? Yes, Rick is correct. But for the first time, we're going to be making decisions about adults who are earning a salary. There will be some errors, and that will be unfortunate. But we aren't going to have children suffer by being in classrooms with teachers who are ineffective year after year. Now we will identify those teachers. We will provide them extra help and training to improve their practice.
Allison, what's the pushback from teachers themselves?
I think that's a great question, Diane, and that's sort of where the value add debate may succeed or fail. A lot of unions, especially, and teachers are very skeptical of this measure for many of the reasons that Rick outlined. It's fairly new practice. They feel that the tests themselves aren't nuanced enough to fully measure their performance. And even some value-added experts really say that it should only be about 50%, no more than 50% of a teacher's evaluation, that you really do need to look at other factors, you know, including observations, other measures like that.
Absolutely. Yes, I absolutely agree. One of the interesting things is the discussion about differential pay and pay for performance and looking at test scores. We finally have uncovered the fact that evaluations of teachers have been meaningless for years. And there's been huge progress in the last year, year and a half in developing really high quality evaluations that look at several gradations of teacher performance. And it's done by observation of principals, observation by peer teachers. And master teachers, and with recording how these teachers are doing and factoring it into the evaluation. So we're not talking about looking at test scores alone.
How concerned are you about the election and changes at the top as far as states are concerned?
Well, Rick made some good points, but one of the good things, frankly, one of the best things about working in education policy for me personally is it is much less partisan than a lot of other issues we're dealing with in
but
this country.
But might not governors who are not in favor of these programs simply say, we're not going to do this?
They may, but I there is strong bipartisan support, strong Republican support for improving the quality of education in this country.
Cindy Brown, she's Vice President for Education Policy at the Center for American Progress. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're going to open the phones now, 800-433-8850. First to Durham, North Carolina. Good morning, Oscar. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Listen, before I make my first, before I make my main point, I like to have three disclosures. One, I am not a teacher. Two, I am a parent of a 18-month-old and a 3-year-old, so my children will not be in school anytime soon. And three, I graduated from the Naval Academy with merit, but I was never able to take standardized test and get really high marks on it. I always got average marks on it. So I did graduate from a fairly good institution, but I was never a good test taker. So my point is that, you know, you can have all these children take all these standardized tests and hold the teachers accountable, but you're really not able to tell whether those teachers are good teachers or bad teachers from standardized tests, not from students. I think that the whole point, I'm glad everyone's talking about education. That's great. However, you're missing the point. If you send an unruly child to school, an unruly child who doesn't behave, you're just basically asking the teachers to be babysitters, not teachers. A student must meet the teacher halfway. He must want to go, he or she must want to go to class and learn. And that is a problem that needs to be addressed at home.
Rick Hess.
I think the listener makes terrific points. I think all of us in the education policy conversation recognize that there's only so much that schools and policy can do. And I think the president has given a couple of terrific speeches on parental responsibility in recent years.
Okay, what about not good test takers?
Sure. I would say, look, unless we believe that not good test takers are going to be asymmetrically, unevenly distributed across the population, it's absolutely true, but the same is true in any walk of life. Ratings in every market are not equal, but nonetheless, television stations or radio stations try to compare the popularity of their shows based on ratings because they figure out that inequities and unevenness of that kind of smooth out. I would say, look, there's four real reasons to be concerned about using these tests to judge teacher quality. One is there's these technical considerations that the experts worry about. A second is that we can only generate value-added scores for about 25% of teachers today, the ones who teach really grades 4 to 8 reading and math. Third, the reality is that if I'm a fifth grade teacher and my students are being pulled out to work with a reading instructor or a coach, my students might do really well or really poorly, not because I'm a good teacher, but because of the coach is good or bad. And right now, our systems can't make those distinctions. And fourth, reading and math gains are a big part of what we care about, but they're not all that we care about. And we risk defining good teaching only in terms of these narrow elements. Like I said before, I'm with Cindy. I think these are huge advances. I think we have to use them. But I think, as the listener cautioned, we've got to use them as tools and not as the whole ballgame.
Cindy.
I agree with Rick, although I think that there are a number of districts and states that are working to develop other kinds of student outcome achievement measures, not just using the state test, which is what Rick was referring to. And so in some places like Denver, teachers themselves set objectives, hard data objectives for their performance, and then they're measured at the end of the year against them. There are other kinds of interim tests.
But you've still got tests at the bottom. Tests are the measure by which a teacher performance is judged.
Only in part. Only in part.
Only in part, Allison.
Well, right now, yes, it's only in part. And at most, a state in their Race to the Top applications said that they wanted it to be 50% of a teacher's score. And other states said that they just wanted it to be a significant factor. So
Allison,
it's not the whole ballgame.
Klein, she's a staff writer for Education Week. Short break and more of your calls when we come back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation, whose four-day Dodge Poetry Festival starts October 7th in Newark, New Jersey, at dodgepoetry.org. And by CSX, working to reduce traffic and pollution while moving 1 million tons of freight daily. CSX, how tomorrow moves. This is NPR.
Honey is a global food, part of tradition, culture, and trade. But the story is not all sweet. It involves smuggling, deforestation, and climate change. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And we're back. We'll go right to the phones to Lee. He's in Jacksonville, Florida. Good morning. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Diane. I am a former teacher, and I had the privilege of teaching in a couple of very elite schools with very high outcomes. And I also taught in an urban core charter school where the population was 100% free lunch. And there's a couple of things I'd like to comment regarding assessment of the teacher. In my previous life in the private sector, there was such a thing as 360-degree review. And without that being a formal policy. That's actually what happens in a lot of the private schools, because you have children going home and talking to their parents about their day, and then you have parents very concerned. And one thing I found in the urban core school was that, and I taught third grade, there was really very little difference in the nature of the children in the 100% free lunch with that had a lot of students with parents that actually were in the correctional system. But even at third grade, they're still the same as the third grade kids I dealt with from the highest level, what you would say, old money families in Jacksonville. But what was different was their parents and they themselves weren't given a voice in assessing their teachers. And I think that that would be a really valuable component to go along with the testing, because one thing we did in the private schools, again, which the Duval County schools haven't been able to probably come up with the money for yet, is testing in the fall and the spring. So you measure the actual progress, you know, from September through to May.
Yeah.
And if you would combine that whole package, I think that you could meet the needs of all the children.
Interesting. Cindy Brown.
Well, I think it's very good to have parents' voice expressed in evaluating teachers. So I have no quarrel with what she said at all.
But go ahead.
You know, one other comment I had to make was the accountability needs to go all the way up the food chain, because here in Jacksonville we have the best of both worlds, or the, you know, there was it? It was the worst of times and the best of times. We have three of the best schools in the country. We have Douglas, Anderson, Stanton, and Paxson. And at the same time, we have the vast majority of the district is underperforming. And this year, we had a record number of F schools at the elementary level. And yet the superintendent received a positive review from the school board and an attaboy and great job. And if I were a parent of the children in those F schools, I'd be very concerned that
okay.
My superintendent.
All right, Lee, thanks for calling. Allison, what's your reaction as far as bringing in parental assessment of teachers?
I think, you know, it's important for parents to have a voice in how schools are improved. I don't think that there is anyone out there who in education policy, Republicans and Democrats, who don't think that the community is an important factor. The question is always, how do you do that? What does that actually look like in legislation? What does it look like in regulations? And I don't know if anybody has figured out a good way to do that, especially at the federal level. It's just a really tricky task.
Okay. Rick Hess, you're basically against the president's Race to the Top program. Talk about why.
Sure. I mean, I think the intuitions behind it were good ones. I think the notion that we want to provide political cover to states to push forward is important. Three real concerns. One is that I think we've been far too easy on the administration's reform agenda. There's $120 billion we've put into education between the stimulus bill and EduJobs. The administration basically pushed $115 billion out the door, and all of that was to justify the $5 billion in the I-3 and the Race to the Top Reform Fund. I think we've been just far too easy in the grading curve we've used when we talk about how much reform this has delivered. Second, Race to the Top was not about, primarily to my mind, knocking down anachronistic programs and structures that get in the way of folks fixing schools in the states and districts. Cindy alluded to the data firewalls that were put in place in the 1970s, laws that said you could not link student data to teachers. Race to the Top deserves kudos for helping to knock those down. But that only accounts for about 20 or 30% of Race to the Top. Most of Race to the Top, when I look at the 500 points across 19 categories, is for flavors of the month best practices that happen to be embraced by the administration today, which is no different from the way we've promoted flavor of the month reform for the past 40 years. This is stuff related to school turnarounds, the way that we pay teachers, asking states to make sure they spend more money. What I don't see is any serious effort to create room for folks to solve problems.
So what you're saying is you feel that this program is not very different from No Child Left Behind.
From the intervention plans that states proposed, part of No Child Left Behind asked states to give large, vacuous promises about what they were going to do when schools didn't deliver the performance results that No Child Left Behind expected. if you read today's 500-page Race to the Top applications filled with vacuous assurances from school districts and union locals, filled with empty prose provided by professional grant writers, I think it looks quite similar.
Allison.
Well, certainly there's been a lot of controversy over how over the Race to the Top scoring system. And in particular, there were two states that everybody sort of expected would get this money. They've really been on the forefront in terms of data and in terms of embracing at least the administration's views on teacher quality, and that's Colorado and also Louisiana. And folks, including Rec, were real surprised when those states weren't selected for grants. So yes, there's been a lot of skepticism about the scoring system.
What about that?
Well, you know, you're kind of darned if you do, darned if you don't. the administration set up a peer review system to look at these grants, and the alternative would have been federal bureaucrats making decisions about who would win the grants, and then using political decisions by Arne Duncan at the end. What they did was have peer reviewers. They came up with scores, and he followed them to the letter. There were some surprises in there, of course. But I do have to disagree with Rick about the value of Race to the Top. There were a total of 28 states that changed major state policies with regard to how they operate schools, all in response to the Race to the Top opportunity for pretty significant funding. We've never seen that kind of change that fast. And we have to remember that we have a very decentralized system of education in this country. The federal government provides at most about 9 or 10% of the funding for schools in this country. The decisions are made at the state and local level. And this was an effort by the federal government, by putting some money out there for them to compete for, to change state behavior. And I think you could say in a majority of states there were significant changes.
All right, let's go to Greensboro, North Carolina. Good morning, Lee. You're on the air.
Oh, good morning. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
Good. I get really upset when you get on this topic of education. My wife is a teacher, and she just comes home every night just stressed out. You know, you have one person in a class of 29 children, you know, four or five of the kids don't speak English, and maybe two or three of them need extra attention. And so they're supposed to set guidelines and teach for all of these children in here, and it's difficult. No teacher assistant, and I don't understand how the system is working for the child, because it just seems like the way all this works out, it's the child that ends up suffering or being, you know. I had a 19-year-old boy come work for me. He couldn't tell me what 9 times 8 was, and he had just graduated.
Cindy Brown.
Well, first of all, teaching is a very difficult job, and successful teachers work miracles, and we should all be grateful for that. We have to change the way we do our teaching. We train our teachers, the way we use technology. Rick has written some about that. Something's not working with the way we're providing education in this country. We're losing ground relative to other countries. And all of us have to work very hard in improving the situation. It is not, I feel for this man and his wife. She's obviously working very hard.
Allison, explain the teacher incentive fund, which is another component of the administration's plan.
Yes, the Teacher Incentive Fund actually was developed under the Bush administration, but the Obama administration has really been very aggressive in pumping funding into that program. And basically what the Teacher Incentive Fund is it's a program that doles out grants to districts that want to try out so-called pay-for-performance programs, which would take a teacher's effectiveness into account in determining how much money they receive.
And how would that measurement be calculated?
Well, that would vary. That varies from district to district. It's a competitive grant program. It's reviewed by folks at the Department of Education. If they feel that the measurement is accurate, they will. It's a way to try it out. It's a way to experiment with this concept.
How long does anybody think it's going to take before we know if any of these reform programs are actually working, Rick?
It's going to be a while. There's two ways to think about whether they work. One is, if we're thinking about merit pay plans, for instance, or school turnarounds, is we have relatively sophisticated experimental design models where we can look at some students' test scores and other students' test scores. Again, it's all being judged in terms of test scores. And over a 2 or 3 year window, we can see whether we see significant gains. But if the larger argument for changing the way we pay teachers is that we're going to attract and keep folks who are talented and dynamic for a longer stretch, and we're going to keep them from wandering off to other fields, really the question is going to be, what does a teacher workforce look like 10 or 15 years from now? And there's no way to do that research until it 10 or 15 years pass.
You really have to be dedicated to be a teacher, do you not, Cindy?
Oh, absolutely. You have to love working with children and watching them grow and learn. And that's what the best teachers do in this country.
Because they're certainly not working for large amounts of money.
No, they aren't. But we know that particularly younger teachers today, when you poll them, they're quite supportive of moving to pay for performance systems. They want to be judged on the quality of their work, just like their peers are in the other kinds of professions they go into. And hopefully by being people who are successful in their work like to stay in that line of work. And if we can attract really talented young people into teaching, reward them when they're successful, hopefully we can keep them.
All right. To Waynesboro, Pennsylvania, at a time when you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Pat, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Morning, Pat.
A regular listener.
I'm so glad.
Part of the discussion disturbs me this morning. I'm by way of the other gentleman who said that his wife was a teacher. I'm on our local school board, and my husband and I are both retired from the local school district. I think we're talking so much about teacher accountability, and we are leaving out the piece of parental accountability. With parents can evaluate teacher accountability, why can't it go the other direction? Parents are the common denominator in a child's life. A child could have 20 teachers, 25 teachers over the course from kindergarten to 12th grade. But who's the one constant, almost the constant, in that child's life? It is the parent. And yet, teachers' absenteeism, children not doing their homework, coming to school not dressed, parents not showing up for teacher conferences. There are so many roadblocks being put before teachers in the classroom today. And might I ask how many of your panel have been teachers?
Not I, certainly. Anyone?
I have.
How many years?
I taught for 2, taught at the Curry School of Education for 5, and supervised teachers for 5.
I've not been a teacher, but my mother was a longtime teacher.
Well, my mother was a longtime teacher, and my mother-in-law was a longtime teacher. We come from an educational family. And if any of you read Robert Samuelson's column in yesterday's paper, he had some interesting statistics about the fact that the NAEP test, which has been around for 40, 50 years, we haven't shown any progress in that 50 years. None whatsoever. And look at all the different things we've tried.
All right, Pat, I appreciate your call. I do think there's lots of responsibility to go around. One person has written a saying, there are clearly many very intelligent and dedicated people working in classrooms across America, President Obama has been quite honest about the fact that some educators are simply not qualified to teach effectively. She goes on to say, during the decade I worked as a high school English instructor, I was stunned by the fact that few of my colleagues possessed an actual college degree in the subject they were teaching. She, one woman laughingly reported she received a grade of D in the only literature course she ever completed. Hang on to that teacher's edition, she was fond of saying. Lots of problems out there. We shall see whether the administration's approach works. It's going to take a while. And I thank all of you for coming in here. Cindy Brown, she's Vice President for Education Policy, Center for American Progress. Frederick Hess, he's at the American Enterprise Institute. And Allison Klein, she's a staff writer for Education Week. Arnie Duncan, the Secretary of Education in the Obama administration, was on the line with us at the start of the program. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales.